This one time in Russia, my wife and I got hungry. Russia was never top of mind when I thought of where I'd go for my next vacation. So when I had a work opportunity to teach a course, Jessica decided to hop on board, we'd add a week, and take a look around. Having grown up in the 70s and 80s, to stand in Red Square would be so weird, and it was. Seeing as how we travel for food, Russia provided a particular challenge, and we were ready to dig deep and find those culinary gems. Funny thing about Russia, if breakfast eateries do exist, they are completely hidden. That is, except if we wanted to cave and eat an Egg McMuffin. We didn't. So we walked, and we walked, and walked, got hungry, and then we got mad. It was suddenly 10:30 a.m., and we were withered versions of our former selves. Just before St. Petersburg had the chance to break us, a bar and grill appeared out of nowhere. And it was open! Correction, the place was empty, and I don't think it was actually open for business, though the front door was unlocked as we entered. It may have been our desperate, disheveled look, but a kindly server who was obviously just turning up to prep for the real opening at noon offered to see what was in the kitchen already prepared. We so gladly accepted, and frankly, the mystery of what would come out of that kitchen added a requisite intrigue to our Russian adventure. I think you already know where this is going, friends. Beef stroganoff was the best breakfast we never knew we needed. My name is Howie Southworth. I travel, I eat, I cook, and then I write fancy words about all of it. My cookbooks are loaded with wild stories and fabulous bites, and I've shared plenty of my own adventures. But now, I want to hear somebody else's for a change. Sauced in Translation is a timely podcast spanning the globe of food, spinning tales of lavish meals and epic gastronomic failure. Join us for some well-deserved armchair globetrotting. Let's get saucy. My guest today is Linda Palacio. Linda is the host and producer of A Taste of the Past on Heritage Radio Network. On the show with a variety of academics, writers, and other food folks of note, she explores history through the lens of food. A culinary historian by trade, Linda dives into sundry topics such as Winston Churchill's personal chef, the industrialization of meat, foodways of the Basque region, and the origins of the coconut. She's even had me as a guest talking about Chinese street food. Can you imagine? Here's our chat. Linda, you are one of the loudest voices of my nerdiness. Back in culinary school, when I decided that being a chef was the hours alone would kill me, I decided that doing a deep dive into food history was going to be my thing. Your podcast seems to follow my train of thought more often than it doesn't. One eerie example was your latest episode. I'm currently researching the possibility that Alexandria, Virginia, my home of 17 years, had a distinct cuisine in the 1800s, since it had access to literal world of ingredients and once enslaved, highly trained cooks. So I pick up A Taste of the Past and boom, you're interviewing Jessica Harris about the influence of African diaspora on early American cuisine. It was a terrific, terrific listen. What did you think of that talk?
Well, Jessica Harris is a good friend and always an easy interview because she is so knowledgeable about the African diaspora, but also, you know, general food history. I wish we would have had more time. I wish we could have been at the exhibit, you know, and seen this we talked about the legacy quilt, which is honoring all the faces and voices and people who were primarily slaves initially, who contributed to the formation of American cuisine. It was just so, you know, too much information for one show. What can I say?
I've been going down a rabbit hole as I'm discovering a lot of the influences, not only of from Nigerian cuisine at large, but Igbo cuisine specifically. And there's a lot of eerie similarities between what was at the time considered the Scottish or British foundation of cuisine that was then tweaked by the people in the kitchen. It was much more influenced by what the Igbo people had within their own traditions. Kind of a cool set of discoveries. So how you been? So this has been a weird kind of era. Indeed. How has it affected Linda Palacio and the way she eats?
Well, number one, I think I can share this with everybody who's probably in the same boat. I've been eating too much, far too much. You know, that the all those hours needing to be filled, I filled it by cooking and eating and things that I don't normally eat. You know, making bread. Who didn't make a loaf of bread, you know, during the pandemic? But bread and baking, too many things. And now all the kids and grandkids are gone. There's just my husband and myself. So that leaves just two of us to eat everything that I was cooking. And I think we were up at our country place. I learned a lot about the farmers and the food there because I was going to small farms and where you know, I would just phone ahead because they would put out a list. Local agencies would put out a list. So I would phone ahead and say, well, what have you got and what can I get? And then I'd, you know, phone in an order. So shopping meant going to about five different places, not getting out of my car necessarily. I'd phone ahead and everything would be packaged up. And then I'd phone when I got there and someone would run it out and put it in the trunk of the car. I mean, you know, it was phenomenal. And I had to experiment with everything that was around. When I came back to New York City, you know, I didn't have to cook so much anymore. There was this world of takeout, which we didn't have up in the country. You know, there are no takeout restaurants. You can't order and have something prepared. It's just ingredients that you have to cook with. Coming back to the city and ordering, I noticed that exact thing that some of the restaurants would even have time slots like reservations for ordering the food that would be delivered or for you to come and pick up. And, you know, when that time slot was taken, you had to go to the next time slot. And that was so ingenious because it kept the kitchen, you know, on an equalized basis. Of course, everyone wants to order their dinner at 6:30 or 7 o'clock, you know, to be ready in an hour. And this way they were able to, you know, to make the best use of the time in the kitchen.
Just a fascinating change because now I'll be sitting on the couch with my wife on a Saturday morning and we're like talking about dinner. And not only are we talking about dinner, we're ordering it and saying, okay, we're going to get it at 7:30. Fantastic. If you can recall your last great trip and what you ate, can you share that with us?
Well, my last trip was in fact, right before everything shut down, it was to Italy, to Rome. But we lived in Rome for a long time, my husband and I. And so that kind of is what inspired my whole indulgent trip into culinary history. We go there a lot, so we'll eat the same things, and they're excellent, and we're good, and we see the changes. So I think that I wouldn't say that was my last greatest eating experience on a trip. I think I have to go back a year prior to that when I went to Barcelona and San Sebastian. You had just left. I was counting on you to be my guide, right? and of course, as I was planning that trip, you informed me that you had just left and you were back in stateside. All right. Thanks a lot, Howie. But I believe
I sent you.
You sent me a great list. Yes, you did. You did.
And did you use any of that list?
I did. And then I used a few others from other people who had just been there. But actually, when we went up to San Sebastian, I guess that was the highlight. That was really terrific. And even though we ate in some pretty fantastic places, Estabaria being one of them. I guess I'd have to say that was an incredible meal. And then, of course, I loved going around, you know, in the town of San Sebastian. I just loved walking around to all the bars and taking advantage of the pincho. Yeah, pincho.
Pinchos.
Yeah, that was just a wonderful experience.
I'll tell you, one of the greatest things about eating around San Sebastian, where you have in your mind, you walk into a pincho bar and the bar is just loaded up with different platters of different pieces of starch, usually bread, topped with all sundry vegetables or seafood or meat, cured sausages and such. There's always a hot menu as well. And the hot menu is either a secret menu or it's written on a chalkboard out front. Let me tell you something. Getting a layer deeper into a pincho bar and only ordering the hot foods, I find that it allows you to eat less because when you walk into these places, your eyes are bigger than your stomach and it's easy to just go crazy. do you have a favorite travel food story?
I have several favorite travel stories. I think this travel story is probably just everything. When everything clicks and everything is right, you know, and it's all just really, you know, the perfect storm. We were in Paris. I love French food. I mean, I'm still an Italophile. I guess it's because it's just sort of, and I'm not Italian at all, by the way. Palacio might lead people to believe I am, but I'm Polish. I will often think that the Parisian food particularly, I mean, it's always delicious and wonderful, but perhaps to my taste buds, maybe a little too fussy. And we had the opportunity to stay at the Park Hotel, and Alain Ducasse had just taken over the restaurant at the Park Hotel. And I talked to a very good friend of mine here in New York, Ariane Degen, who is the owner of D'Artagnan. It's a online food site for meats and things. I said, I'm going to be going there. She said, oh, you know, you would love it so much. And she said, well, let me, you know, I'll tell chef that you're coming. Oh, okay. I never say no to that. So there we were, and we were sitting in this gorgeous, I mean, anyone who has not had like feel like royalty when they've gone to a restaurant, we felt like royalty. You walk in and there's a whole line of chefs, you know, it's like that, you know, hello, 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 all the way down the line, and you greet each one of them. And then we're sitting at this phenomenal, beautiful table in this gorgeous room. I mean, it's just probably the most beautiful dining room I had ever been in. And there were all these international big wigs sitting all around us who were probably princes from other countries. I don't know. And here we were, you know, the Americans, you know, coming to spend their bucks at this, you know, this fancy place. But they treated us like, you know, we had crowns on our head. They treated us like royalty. And it was really, truly a phenomenal dinner. And I ordered things that I would not have ordered any other time, like fat on fat. That was one of the dishes I ordered. I mean, it was, in a way, it was called something quite beautiful, like, you know, lard on lard. I mean, you know, it was the pork belly cooked in other type of lard with some sliced other lard on the plate. Did I finish? No, I could not finish it. I mean, even though the portion was small, but oh, it was a wonderful taste experience. It was really incredible. Now let's get back to the wine. My husband had something clearly, you know, very special in mind that he wanted to order for the wine. And I said, well, let's talk about it. So we talked about it and I said, yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, I can't even go back to what in particular it was. But then he talked to the sommelier, who said, yes, but I think maybe you would want, and then the sommelier brought what his suggestion was, and my husband took a taste of the wine, and he said, you know, and he said, I'm sorry, this just doesn't please my palate. It's not what I had had in mind.
Oof, not a comfortable conversation.
Not at all. And I said, oh boy, here goes our great experience, right? And this was, you know, early on in the dinner. And the sommelier didn't react basically. He just took it in stride and dealt with the situation with such tact and aplomb that I mean, that surprised us, and you know, we were feeling terribly guilty. Brought a wine that my husband had found on the list that he knew he would like, that he did like. And it was wonderful, and we enjoyed the meal, and it was, you know, a comparable price as well. Not like we were going for the cheap one on the list. And then at the end of the dinner, which was something like, I don't know, 3.5 hours long.
Wow.
They said, so for your coffee and an after dinner drink or something, they issued us back downstairs to sit in the bar area. And we said, oh, this is fun. We'll finish off the dinner. Thank God we were staying in the hotel because we couldn't move after that. And they're lying on the table of the little seats in the bar that we had to enjoy our coffee is the latest edition of Wine Spectator. And who is on the cover of Wine Spectator but the sommelier of the restaurant? And my husband just started to melt.
As you're telling the story, my brain went two distinct directions. This is either going to go horribly, or it's going to be handled with more grace than I would have.
And he was a true professional. He deserved being on the cover.
And the best part is that no matter which direction the story had gone, it has the perfect punchline. That punchline of the magazine being presented to you where the sommelier is on the cover is brilliant. That is brilliant. It sounds amazing. It sounds, I would not be able to do that meal unsarcastically. I have a physical reaction to when someone talks about Paris. I had a rough time eating in Paris. This is going to come off as such a surprise. I love food so much, and I've eaten in a lot of very cool places in the world. I could not find a good meal. And it wasn't for lack of trying. It may have been my assumption that anywhere I went would be fantastic. Two meals in, I was toast. I was like, what am I going to do? I can't believe I hate the food in Paris. And it was an attitude problem. But the adjustment came as we're walking through a park and it was drizzling. And I stopped by a little crepe cart and had myself a ham and cheese crepe.
Yeah, it's those experiences that always turn out to be the memorable ones.
Linda, I'm telling you, it just warmed my entire attitude, complete overhaul. And from there out, I enjoyed the rest of what I could of Paris. But I'm glad I had that experience of not enjoying it so that when I did enjoy it, it was that much more effective. Jessica and I, my wife, we do a nicer restaurant every once in a while. We've done some Michelin places, one in Barcelona. It was a two-star and it was out of this world. But the pretense is so heavy.
Yes, yes.
The pretense is so heavy that I often react with that chiding and sarcasm. I react because I don't believe that I'm good enough to be there at that moment. The two-star meal that we had was at the Meridian Hotel. It was a restaurant called Moments, and it was a Catalan menu, but it was two-star Catalan food, which is kind of funny. In my mind, it's the opposite of Catalan food. If Catalan food could get negative stars, it would gladly take them because it is a peasant cuisine. It is a humble cuisine. So what the chef was very creatively doing, taking things that were very, very rudimentary and Michelining them up, which was a crazy experience. And for that, from an anthropological culinary perspective, I appreciated the experience. And I think that took some of the edge off and allowed me to actually enjoy the meal instead of poking fun at the concept of it being hoity-toity. How did you work off your meals in Paris? Or how do you tend to walk off your meals anywhere you travel?
Walking, as you just said, walking. I mean, just there, you know, usually we're someplace where we have so many destinations, some places we want to see. And we had not traveled to Paris, but one other very, very brief time. So we had to see everything.
It's like mentioning Paris opening this old wound. But like after that magical crepe in the park in the light rain, the next morning we get up and we're going to walk up Sacré-Cœur. It is driving rain. And just freezing. So it's as if the gods saw me starting to be happy with my experience in Paris and said, "F you," right? We're going to go see Sacré-Cœur. We had to go see Sacré-Cœur. And we didn't stand in line to go into the church. We went to the rooftop, which was fantastic. But again, out into the cold rain. But we sat shoulder to shoulder in the smallest bistro we could find. And I had the best cassoulet. I went from like very miserable to like the happiest kid in the world once that cassoulet hit the table.
Well, you asked me what my best travel experience was. You didn't necessarily say best meal, because I have to say that similarly, the small little bistro meals, something that we just happened upon and didn't make reservations far in advance, were always the best.
Do you have a worst food travel story?
It may not qualify as worst. Bizarre, maybe. We were in Italy we lived in Rome for 5 years. During that time, we didn't have a penny to our name, so we didn't travel around a whole lot. at that time. That was way back when. And we did go to, we had to go to Naples a couple of times. Well, this one time we had to go to Naples, finally had a car after many years of, you know, busing it. Friends of ours said, oh, gee, would you mind taking our friend, whose name happened to be Howie, would you mind taking our friend Howie with you to the train station? He's got to, you know, go wherever he was going. I don't know. So we said, sure, we'll do that. So we, you know, we were driving down and made the trip fun. It's not a long trip, a couple hours. And we then we decided, well, we've got to stop for lunch because we're really, or dinner or whatever it was, what some meal. Well, we stopped and we said, well, we want to travel. We wanted to go and see as far as we could on Mount Vesuvius. So we're driving up this trail to Mount Vesuvius. Oh, we'll probably pass something along the way. What? Not at that time. We didn't pass. We didn't pass a whole lot. So sure enough, there's this sign and it's for an osteria, which used to mean, you know, a place to stay and a place to eat. But this was just a place to eat and had probably at one time was a neon sign, but it wasn't on. I said, well, I don't even know if they're open. Let's go check. And sure enough, they're open. And at one table, there's a lot of noise coming. And it's a table of nearby priests or monks or seminarians or something, you know, and you figure, oh, if they're eating in the place, it's probably good, right? You know, and they're all raising a ruckus. So we said, okay, we're going to go in. We're going to eat. So we sit down, we don't have much money, but you know, how much can a bowl of pasta cost, right? So, you know, you walk in and we're going to get the basics. Yeah, give us a, you know, a bowl of, you know, pasta with, well, what, like pasta with what? The little old lady comes out to take our order, old and little.
In and, Italy, that's just a shock.
Yeah, right. And there, we were the only other people in the place. It just had these plain wooden tables. And we said, yeah, okay, just some, okay, spaghetti. I have some spaghetti. Okay, spaghetti. And with, I don't know, amatriciana sauce or just plain tomato. I have tomato papaya. I have tomato sauce. I said, okay, just tomato sauce and bring it. We're hungry. And we said, and maybe in the meantime, you could bring us some bread. We're really hungry. And she got this shocking look on her face. Bread? We said, yeah, like a big loaf of casareccia, which is like, home style bread. They're eating over there at that table. Oh, no, no. I signore, I padre. They brought their own bread to the restaurant. And I went, ooh, this might not be a good experience. They had to bring their own bread to the restaurant. So we sit there, we wait, maybe it'll be okay. She had wine. So we said, fine, bring on the wine. We're drinking wine, figure after a couple glasses, you know, we won't care so much. We waited and waited and nothing happened. Nothing arrived. And so finally, you know, the guys kind of cajole me. You go in the kitchen, you find out what's going on. So I said, all right. I get up, I go into the kitchen and there are just these two little old ladies. So there's another one back there and she's all in black and they couldn't have been more than 4 feet tall. And they're all very confused and saying, we're not sure what we should. I said, is there a problem for our spaghetti? Oh, well, the spaghetti's cooking, but we're not really sure. And then here's the can of tomato. I said, do you need help opening the can? Oh, yes. And so, there I am standing at the kitchen counter opening the can of tomatoes for these women. And I said, well, you know, do you have some olive oil? And they said, oh, yes, we have some. So basically, I made the meal for us and then took it back out. We never quite. And by the time we polished off all the wine that they kept bringing out, I don't even remember whether they actually served food in this restaurant or the sign was an old one that was just still there. And the priests just come and always have their lunchtime meal there. Whatever it was, by the time I finished it, brought it out, it was passable. It was good. It was weird. You know? And we didn't have bread to start out the meal anyway. It didn't matter. But we ate our pasta, drank more wine than we should have, and then made our way back down the mountain.
I kind of felt at some point during that story that you were going to reveal that it was just one of their houses. Here this American woman walks in and says, we're going to have you give us pasta. And she's like, okay. Now you can go all the way up to the top crater on Vesuvius. It's a lot of fun. When we got up there, though, my younger son, who's now 11, saw the steam coming out of the crater, which of course is always steam coming out of the crater. It didn't take me by surprise, but he's like, this thing is going to blow. So I, you know, played along a little bit and we were like, okay, so if it were to blow, where would you run to? And so we're like, you know, getting all scientific about it. Well, the wind is going this way. The slope on this side is this steep and we can run this fast. Are you familiar with Eddie Schoenfeld?
Sure. I know Ed. Okay. Yeah.
Ed and Elisa visited Barcelona. He let me know they were going to be in town. He showed up the day before we were supposed to go to Naples. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to Naples with the family this weekend. He's like, hey, Elisa and I just got back. And I was there talking to this writer who his job is to travel around Italy writing about the best pizzas. He just published his new list of Naples. And I'm going to put you in touch. And so my family and I decided that we were going to take Arturo's list and exclusively eat pizza, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so we did. We had 3.5 days. We had 11 or 12 meals, each of them going through Arturo's list. And my God, they call Naples the pizza capital. It truly, truly is.
Tell me you went to Don Michele's.
Oh, of course. The funny thing about Don Michele's is this a classic place in Naples where they have two pizzas. They have a margarita and they have a marinara. And the marinara is exactly as it sounds, is just a pizza with no cheese and just a marinara sauce. And let me tell you something. That was a conversion, that meal. That converted me. Marinara pizza is great if the sauce is great. But the other thing about Don Michele is the dining room is tiny. They do two things in the world, margarita and marinara. And you wait because there's no reservation system. You just show up. And the street in front of this place is consistently a parking lot of people.
Right.
And you wait till the guy says your name at the door. And then you go in and you know, they have the pizzas ready already. They're just flying out of a 90-second oven. And you sit, you eat, you leave. So we were there, you know, 20 minutes.
And I have to say, pizza outside of Naples, just, I don't care if you follow it to a T, and if you have a 950-degree oven, it doesn't taste the same outside of Naples. It just is special.
No, it doesn't. They could get close, but they never get it on the nose. Okay, so Linda, we have reached the time of the show where I give you five fill in the blanks. Blank will be my last meal.
Pasta.
You're going to have to make it yourself.
I have to make it myself, right? But then I always do. It's my default meal when, you know, when there's nothing else in the house to make. There's always pasta. There's always olive oil, you know.
I cook blank to impress people.
The flip answer would be pasta because I do. But it'll be something unusual that they may not have heard of or don't do as well. But the other thing is perhaps a risotto with porcini. It's because so few people understand true risotto. And so I make it and they go, but, and I said, it's like soup. Yeah, it's risotto. Yeah.
I think you're like me as a cook where I cook to tell a story. I cook to be evocative. That's the reason I'm in the kitchen in the first place, so that you can cook something interesting enough to carry a conversation should nothing else come up.
That's true. You're absolutely right.
I cook blank to comfort myself.
Probably falling back on my Polish roots with potato soup.
What would distinguish a Polish potato soup from other potato soups?
Well, it would be my mother's Polish potato soup. And the whole family kind of broke away. So she was not, I didn't really grow up learning much about her parents and grandparents cooking, and they were gone. So when I was growing up, it was very meager, very watery. This is a woman who would have a mashed potato sandwich for lunch when she wanted to comfort herself. So potatoes always figured very large and in our diet. She was most comfortable cooking those. In fact, it was the first thing I really learned how to make were mashed potatoes. So when I first got married and made them for my husband, we were a family of six. I made mashed potatoes for a family of six, you know. That's what I knew were potatoes.
The one food I would erase from the earth is blank.
You know, nothing pops into my mind because I have to say, there isn't a food I've met that I don't like. I'm sure it's out there, but I haven't met it yet. What were you driving at? What would you, you know, like somebody just hates broccoli, so they would just, you know, wipe it off their, I mean, what were you thinking? I mean, food is food. Food is good. Food is precious.
Of course, I am a man of many opinions. I would erase cucumber pickles from the earth. And there's many reasons why. Shall I tell you any of them? It's not just that I find cucumber pickles distasteful. I am offended by the fact that cucumber pickles took the name pickle.
Pickle, right.
Because I absolutely adore, you name it, anything other than cucumbers, pickled is delicious.
A large swath of the population, let's put it that way, doesn't realize the terminology of pickle and what is a pickle. Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, to them, it means one thing and one thing only. Wonderful things that are pickles. And you're right. Now I understand why you asked the question. Okay. You got it.
it boils my blood. Last but certainly not least, blank is for dinner tonight.
I just bought some salmon this morning, so it's going to be salmon, probably very simple, trying to lose some of that COVID weight, you know, but broiled with probably just a little za'atar or some, you know, little spice mm-hmm. on top afterwards, and then served over some just lightly sautéed wilted spinach. Mm. That's sort of a go-to meal, especially when we're dieting. Mm.
That is colorful and delicious sounding. So you are a salmon poacher. You're a poacher.
I'm a broiler because, you know, you broil it and then even if it's not cooked, I don't like it. I like it rare. Even if it's not cooked to your liking, you can let it sit for a while, even after it comes out of the broiler, and it will continue cooking.
Have you ever slow roasted?
I did one time upon a friend's suggestion, just like mm-hmm. you're suggesting.
Just the most beautiful texture. There's a friend of mine who loves salmon, but likes it fully cooked. So once I found this technique, whenever we have a meal together that features salmon, it works so well for both tastes because I want my salmon swimming. He wants his salmon dead. So Linda, what's next? What's your next taste of the past going to be about? What's coming up for you?
I'm going to be talking to Beatrice Ughi. She is the owner of Gustiamo. And Gustiamo is an online marketplace. Well, not even online. If you're living here in New York, you can go up to the Bronx to the warehouse and buy directly. Of very select Italian products that are probably she's trying to protect them. And doing a good job. And even especially olive oils and things that are, you know, there's so much fraud going on in the international marketplace. You know, companies taking over, let's say, an olive oil company and diluting it with some mass marketed oil from probably originally good olives and maybe in Tunisia or someplace, but mass marketed and mass produced. And calling it extra virgin olive oil from, you know, wherever, you know, the San Marzano tomatoes. There's only one place that San Marzano tomatoes grow. But I mean, there are a lot of great tomatoes, but don't call them that. It's the same thing with a lot of people complaining about cultural appropriation. You know, taking my recipe, my food that my country has developed and you cooking it and calling it your own. Well, if they're cooking it and cooking it well, you should appreciate the fact that they're cooking it. As long as they, you know, pay homage to where it originates and where it comes from. I don't have a problem with anyone else cooking it. I think that's a great compliment.
Being someone who has written cookbooks that were so specific, like the Chinese street food book,
right.
Like this next one that's going to be published off the top of my head, TAPA, it's not appropriation if it's appropriately celebrating, right? It's the story. And what I found was I'm finding more of the story is it goes beyond celebrating and not just saying that it's these people who invented this. It's going even a step further back and saying, this isn't even Spanish. So Linda, this has been great. I really appreciate your time. I know you're a very busy producer and host.
Well, thank you. It's as I mentioned when we first communicated about doing this, what fun to be on the other end of the microphone, yeah. To be asked the questions and not asking the questions. It's fun. Well, I look forward to hearing what the other guests have to say.
Great. To all of you wonderful, intelligent listeners out there, remember to subscribe to this show, follow me on Instagram, and find our books with your favorite seller. Those are One Pan to Rule Them All, Kiss My Casserole, How to Cook Anything in Your Dutch Oven, Chinese Street Food, and the forthcoming Off the Top of My Head, Recipes, Rants, and Ravings of an American Cook Obsessing in Barcelona. Until next time, stay saucy and eat well.